Okay, welcome back to Healthspan. I know it's been forever, but I'm back with part two of How Not to Age by Dr. Michael Greger. In this episode, I'll just be continuing with the different pathways of aging, and I wanted to begin with glycation. So back in 1912, there was a French chemist. His name was Louis-Camille Maillard, and he discovered that when you mix proteins and sugars together, there was this browning effect, and we now know this as the Maillard reaction. And the same thing happens in our bodies where we get different glucose molecules attaching to our proteins, and we get formation of these advanced glycation end products. I'm sure you've heard of hemoglobin A1c. This is when glucose molecules attach to our red blood cells, and we're able to measure how well or how poorly controlled someone's diabetes is. So anytime a hemoglobin A1c is between 5.7 to 6.4, they're considered pre-diabetic. Anytime the hemoglobin A1c is greater than 6.4, then they're considered diabetic. Glycation causes proteins to cross-link together, and it often causes stiffening in our tissues, most critically our arteries and the heart muscle itself. This impaired elasticity can result in hypertension, peripheral artery disease, heart disease, kidney disease, and even cancer. And we have these receptors for advanced glycation end products, or RAGEs, that spark inflammation cascade in our bodies. And these advanced glycation end products are implicated in age-related memory decline, impaired wound healing, skin, aging, cataracts, Alzheimer's, and erectile dysfunction. So almost all the things that we associate with age are associated with these advanced glycation end products. As one pathologist put it, it is hard to find an age-related disease that ages are not involved in. So we know these advanced glycation end products have something to do with aging because in mouse models, anytime we inhibit these advanced glycation end products, it has actually been shown to extend the lifespan of model animals, whereas these AGE augmentators can actually cut the lives short of these mouse models. So this kind of leads us into the importance of having good glycemic control, which I'll talk about in a little bit. Journal articles with titles like Extended Lifespan in Mice Exposed to a Low Glycotoxin Diet really exemplify the studies that show that lowering dietary AGEs can really improve our longevity. In one study, for instance, while 76% of the mice fed a low AGE diet, lived at least 56 weeks, not a single one of those mice fed an AGE-rich diet survived after 44 weeks. So we kind of experimented with these high and low glycemic diets, and those with the lower glycemic diets and lower AGE diets, they had less inflammation, less oxidative stress, less insulin resistance, and also lower heart and kidney fibrosis. So again, talking about glycemic load in these advanced glycation end products, hyperglycemia is really never good. It happens, it's a natural response to eating food, but we know some foods are worse and some foods are better at controlling our glycemic, you know, variability. So for example, beans, chickpeas, split peas, fruits, lentils, whole grain breads, these are considered low glycemic foods because they don't really spike your glucose level and thus won't really spike your insulin so much. So beans are exceptionally beneficial for this. By 1980, it had already been shown that beans can cause an exceptionally low blood sugar response, half that of some other common foods. Legumes can benefit your metabolism hours after consumption or even the following day. If you eat lentils for dinner, your body reacts differently to breakfast 11 hours later. And we think the way this works is through the fiber. A lot of the fiber in these legumes and beans, they help produce these short chain fatty acids that get absorbed into our bloodstream and circulate through our body, and it helps reduce the glucose response. There's another important thing you can do as well, which is walking after meals. So since active muscles can often siphon off excessive blood sugars, exercise timing can really complement meal timing. So when type 2 diabetics were randomized to a leisurely 20-minute stroll, either before or after dinner, Researchers found that after dinner, walking can comparatively blunt blood sugar spikes by 30%. Thanks to some tactical timing, the same meal and the same amount and intensity of exercise can give us a significant bonus effect on blood sugar control. Exercising after a meal can bring your blood sugar down just as effectively as some other blood sugar lowering medications. So that's one thing I always advocate to my patients is, even if you don't have a full hour in your day to exercise, if you can just walk 10, 15 minutes after a meal, you will see dramatic changes in your blood glucose level. So if you're diabetic, pre-diabetic, and you want to get your glucose under control, I just recommend a short, leisurely walk or some sort of activity after you eat. So we'll be moving forward. And to help, to summarize again, to slow this aging pathway of glycation, we want to do a lot of things like stop smoking, obviously. Avoid the very worst foods like bacon and hot dogs. Eat any age-less diet by emphasizing lower age foods like fruits and vegetables. You want to favor a lot of raw nuts and seeds, and also choose low glycemic load foods. So this leads us to the next pathway of aging, which is IGF, or insulin-like growth factor. Back in 1993, there was a single genetic mutation that was found to double the lifespan of C. elegans, the roundworm, which is often used in aging research. And a lot of this work was done by this lady. Her name was Cynthia Kenyon, and she recalled that these C. elegans mutants were really one of the most amazing things she's ever seen in her life. They were active and healthy, and they lived more than twice as long as normal. These, again, were the ones with the IGF mutation. They saw that the C. elegans with the IGF mutations, they had better cell maintenance and better autophagy. They were more resilient against stress responses, and they also had better metabolism. Interference with the signaling of the IGF-1 pathway has been shown to extend the lives of a variety of species, not just C. elegans. Mice that have had IGF disrupted lived 42 to 70% longer. And again, Cynthia Kenyon, she stated that they also looked 40 years old when they were actually 80 or even older. And the dialing down of this growth hormone signaling is thought to shift the body's priorities from growth to maintenance and repair, thereby extending our survival. So again, this kind of goes back to the balance of the mTOR and AMPK. We know IGF is actually one of the upstream signaling of mTOR. So when insulin binds to the insulin receptor, we then get activation of the PI3 kinase, and this kinase then goes down and phosphorylates and activates different pathways, including AKT, the STAT3, NF-kappa-B, and also mTOR. So IGF is an upstream signal of the mTOR, which again, implicated in the aging process, more cellular proliferation, more cell survival, and a lot of problems when it's chronically stimulated. Centenarians, or people that live 100 and older, they have lower IGF levels in their blood, but again, is this a cause or effect? IGF levels decline as we age, so did the growth hormone cause centenarians to live longer lives, or did living longer lives cause lower IGF? This kind of led to researchers to look at the IGF-1 levels of the offspring of the children that had lower IGF-1 levels, and that's what they saw. They saw people with low IGF levels, their offspring also had lower IGF levels. And this kind of suggests that lowering IGF levels may give the centenarians a certain advantage that, the normal population really does not have. And he also goes into this section about cancer boosters. So IGF is a potent oncogenic stimulator. So oncogenes are just genes that help really flourish cancer growth. And as you might expect, the higher levels of IGF in the bloodstream, the higher risk of developing certain cancers like breast cancer, colorectal cancer, and also prostate cancer. In the Harvard Nurses Health Study, premenopausal women younger than 50 in the upper third of the IGF levels had nearly 5 times the risk of developing breast cancer compared to those in the lower third. So this kind of gets to the question of how do we reduce our IGF levels with our diet? Well, the most obvious thing you can do is not consume any food at all. Complete fasting can do it. Consuming nothing but water for 5 days can actually temporarily cut your levels of IGF in half. This is why cancer patients often fast for a few days before and after chemotherapy. The reduction in the IGF-1 makes cancer cells more vulnerable to being killed off. And if you want to know more about how this works and why it works, I recommend you listening to my other episode by Dr. Walter Longo, The Longevity Diet. He's kind of the foremost researcher about IGF-1 levels and cancer and the importance of calorie restriction. So I recommend you listening to those podcasts. In rodents, calorie restriction alone can reduce IGF-1 levels. So we can not only fast, but we can also just reduce our calories to help reduce our IGF-1 levels. And at intakes far exceeding recommended consumption, proteins from plants and animals equally raise IGF-1 levels, but at more reasonable levels, animal protein actually appears to be the main culprit. So men and women who avoid things like meats, eggs, and dairy proteins actually have significantly lower IGF-1 levels, even when moderately exceeding the protein recommendation. But when people switched from eating a animal-based to a plant-based diet, their IGF levels can actually drop significantly in less than 2 weeks as well. And it's not an all or nothing thing. He's saying here that a study of women carrying the BRCA mutation who are at risk of developing breast cancer found that IGF-1 levels can be lessened by simply reducing but not completely eliminating animal product consumption across the board. So the point I'm trying to make here is plant-based diet, you can consume less calories, you can fast. There are a lot of ways to lower IGF-1 levels. And just moving a little bit forward here, again, just to recap, food for thought, insulin-like growth factor is considered to be one of the most cardinal importances for cancer expansion. So downregulation of the IGF-1 activity not only has the potential to slow the aging process, but may be a way to turn anti-aging genes against cancer. So IGF-1 is cranked up with high protein diets and also by animal proteins in particular. And this really explains the benefits of a more plant-based eating style, as well as consuming a diet with relatively low proportion of protein. But again, you kind of have this trade-off where you don't consume enough protein, you don't build enough muscle, we need muscle for longevity. And it's this constant debate about how much protein we should be getting in our body. He's saying here that you should strive for 0.8 grams per healthy kilogram of body weight. But I've also heard it as much as doubled, where we should be consuming about 1.6 grams per kilogram of body weight. So again, it's up to you. It's up to what your goals are. If you really want to focus on muscle sparing and muscle mass, I recommend you getting a higher protein diet, like 1.6 grams per kilogram. But again, if you're really focusing on living a long life, living a healthy life, then maybe consuming closer to 0.8 grams per kilogram of protein in mostly plants, then that's the way that I would recommend you going about. So that kind of ends the IGF-1 discussion, and we kind of move forward to the next pathway of aging, which is just inflammation. Again, I hate this general term of inflammation, but I just wanted to point out a few things here that fat is very inflammatory. I've talked about this multiple times. We know that our fat cells secrete a lot of different cytokines that cause havoc in our body, and general inflammation is not very good. We shouldn't be eating a lot of inflammatory foods, and generally components of processed foods and animal products, like, you know, a lot of saturated fats, trans fats, cholesterol, were found to be really pro-inflammatory, while constituents of like whole plant foods like fiber, phytonutrients, are actually very anti-inflammatory. Those eating a more inflammatory diet also appear to experience faster aging at a cellular level. Inflammatory diets have also been linked to worsening mental health, so things like depression, anxiety, and impaired well-being. There's also higher risk of cancer when you're eating more pro-inflammatory foods. The food components that rate as the most pro-inflammatory are, again, saturated fats and trans fats. In the United States, the top five sources of these saturated fats are cheese, desserts like cake and ice cream, chicken dishes, pork, and also burgers. And once again, I play a lot of devil's advocate on this podcast because I consume a whole food plant-based diet, but at the same time, I do eat a lot of meat. I eat a lot of steak, a lot of fish, a lot of chicken. And I think as long as you're getting those non-processed meats, for example, like not bacon, not ham, not a lot of these processed meats, and getting grass-fed, grass-finished beef, I don't believe they're going to be as inflammatory as he's making it out to be in this book. Again, saturated fats may also help endotoxins leak through the gut wall into your circulation. And endotoxins are highly pro-inflammatory structural components of certain bacteria. And as such, you know, you see a lot of these endotoxins in these high bacterial loads in things like meat. So kind of moving forward here, we know that fiber is really good at reducing the oxidative stress and the free radicals that are generated by inflammatory meals. There's a lot of good anti-inflammatory index foods that you can look up, but some of the ones he mentions here are turmeric, ginger, garlic, green or black tea, and just a lot of like whole grains and legumes. Again, chickpeas, beans, lentils, split peas. These are all very good at lowering inflammation, as well as blood sugar, as I mentioned earlier. So why is fiber and these foods that I mentioned so anti-inflammatory? Again, we feed the good bacteria in our gut, and we produce these short-chain fatty acids like butyrate. And researchers found that butyrate suppresses the inflammatory reaction and really tells our immune system to stand down. We know we get lower NF-kappa B, and we get more intestinal mucosal barrier integrity and more tight junctions in our gut, so less, you know, leaking of those endotoxins and lipopolysaccharides. We also get more goblet cells. So more goblet cells, more tight junctions, more intestinal barrier, like integrity. So this is all important and helps reduce the amount of inflammation. Eating more fiber, as I mentioned, butyrate massively enhances the secretion of IL-10, which is an anti-inflammatory cytokine. And we also know that berries are very good at lowering NF-kappa B, so blueberries, blackberries. Any high intake of these anthocyanins, as they call them, any one of these berries that are very like pigmented, have been associated with anti-inflammatory effects. So moving a little bit more forward, cruciferous vegetables, which encompass things like collard greens, kale, and other members in like the broccoli family, have been shown to be very particularly anti-inflammatory. Again, it's all kind of going back to lowering NF-kappa B, which is the essential mediator of inflammation that regulates pro-inflammatory genes. And although it may take eating about 2 pounds a day of this cruciferous vegetables, it has been shown to drop IL-6 levels within 2 weeks and also reduce our CRP levels as well. So again, cruciferous vegetables, berries and legumes, and also nuts as well. Like whole grains and nuts have been linked to lower inflammation in population studies, as well as a lower risk of death from inflammatory diseases. So just to finish off food for thought, aging again can be thought of as an inflammatory disease, an inflammatory process. A single measure of inflammatory markers like CRP or IL-6 can predict physical and cognitive performance, as well as remaining lifespan in elderly individuals. To help slow the aging pathway again, on a daily basis, really consider reducing your advanced glycation, reduce the senescence-associated secretory phenotype from not being obese and not, you know, having so many adipocytes. Really help boost autophagy to clear out these inflammatory cells. And again, you want to eat a lot of avoid a lot of these pro-inflammatory compounds, saturated fats, endotoxins. Minimize your intake of these oils and meats. And we want to eat a lot of anti-inflammatory foods. Again, one more time, legumes, berries, greens, cocoa powder, garlic, ginger, turmeric. These are all good. Anthocyanin-rich and salicylic acid-rich foods like whole organic, unpeeled plants, that kind of thing. So I'll go ahead and end the podcast here. We kind of went through more pathways of aging. We talked about glycation. We talked about inflammation. We talked about IGF. I hope you learned something. I hope you tune in next time. We'll be continuing with more pathways of aging on the next episode. So I hope you tune in next time, and thanks for listening.